Hello, and welcome to Stardust Records, a Star Wars podcast. I'm Savi, and I'm here with my co-host, Linz. And today we will be discussing episode 8, the season finale of The Acolyte. And the episode was titled The Acolyte. And it was an excellent wrap-up to this season, I think, that none of us were expecting to go this direction, but I feel like it was a pleasant surprise. What did you think?
Yeah, I had predicted that Osha and May were going to potentially like team up against Chimer. And that did not happen. They did team up, but not against him.
But
So,
with him.
Yes, with him against somebody else. So, yeah, my expectations were subverted, but pleasantly so. I was not mad about the way that it went.
Yeah, it was definitely a very interesting deviation from, I feel like, the beginning of the season, because there was so much light at the beginning of the season. I feel like we had Yord and Jeki and Sol and the temple and everything was okay and bright. And well, if you notice in the posters, I think that was intentional, because they did the whole eclipse symbolism thing. And somebody pointed this out, so I can't take credit for it, but Chimer, I think it's Kamar, means moon in Arabic, and then Sol in Spanish means sun. And I do feel like that was an intentional, like the moon coming to cover the sun. I thought that was really great. And I know that the, what is it, Oshamir girlies were very happy.
Yes.
So
yes.
I think that we can safely say that we're both Oshamir girlies.
Yes, I dabble a little bit in the Oshamir pool. I kept thinking about the episode. It was on my brain so much ever since it dropped. And just how, like you were saying, this season started in the light and it kind of ended in the dark, but in a sense where I know some people were saying that it kind of had a triumphant feel at the end. And I can't really disagree with them. But also, I really don't know how to pinpoint how I feel about it. Like, I don't feel disappointed. I don't feel upset. It's very strange to me to feel hyped up at the end of a season where, like, our hero dies and darkness kind of prevails, but
yeah.
I almost felt hyped up about it. And
yeah.
I'm not gonna apologize for feeling that way. I don't think that it's trying to put darkness on a pedestal, but I think it's setting the tone for coming seasons, because I do think we will get a season two based on who was revealed in this last episode and just how the last episode ended.
I think that we, as an audience, as specifically like a Star Wars audience, aren't necessarily used to seeing the dark side, I suppose, prevail in this aspect where everything is okay. Like, at the end of Revenge of the Sith with Anakin becoming Darth Vader, I don't feel like that's prevailing. I guess because it's such a violent end, I suppose, but not to compare, but I know that Amandla stated that they didn't state whether it was May or Osha where they felt had a very Anakin-esque inspiration that she had based either of them off of, but I do feel like I see, it's so interesting because I do feel like Chimer is different. I'm not going to be like, oh, you know, there's just something about him that's not bad, because he did kill many Jedi. But I do feel like he has such a complex build to him, because in some way he is soft. And that's what is so interesting about the Sith, I suppose, is that he's actively allowing himself to feel these feelings and emotions towards Osha. Does that make sense what I'm trying to say? He's not to compare the ships, but with Elzar in Temptation of the Force, he is afraid to commit to loving Eivar because he's afraid of attachment. But Chimer is actively welcoming this attachment that he is feeling towards Osha because Elzar does love Eivar, and love and attachment are separate. But Chimer is open to this attachment that he's feeling towards Osha. And he's showing that in these very soft, tender ways, which is so shocking to me because he's so violent and so good at fighting, but he can't help himself when he wants to just very subtly touch Osha. Like, so much so where it was literally just the tip of his thumb.
Yeah, I was thinking about their motivations from the beginning of the episode. So, Osha's under the mask. She has this vision of May, potentially killing Sol. So Osha is like, "Oh, we have to go stop her. Like, I gotta save Sol, basically." And Chimer believes her and thinks May is going to find out how to kill without a lightsaber, without, a weapon. And I'm assuming Chimer knows what that is. I'm assuming Chimer knows what killing without a weapon looks like, and he was just waiting for May to get it. And the force choking. And so he's like, "Well, let's go, And I'm wondering if he, because I wonder what Chimer's intentions were. I don't feel like they were very clear, because he was like, "Well, I gotta go with you." And when he confronts Sol, didn't he say something to the effect of, "You brought her to me," or he's gonna get to her first, kind of thing? Is fighting Sol, and he's like basically implying that May is going to kill him because Chimer is still convinced that May is the one that's going to be killing Sol. But at the very last second, we have May, not using the lightsaber, and it ends up being Osha that does that. It's Osha was experiencing a vision of herself killing Sol. And I think that Chimer was surprised. Like, you can kind of tell that he was a little taken aback, like, "Oh, wait." And so
Well, that
I wonder if he went there because he was like, "Well, if May figures out how to kill without a weapon, then she succeeded and she could still be
the acolyte.
my acolyte." And it turns out it's really Osha. So all of his intentions, but then he even offered to train Osha before they go there. So was he like just waiting to see which of them was going to be? I don't know. Like, Kanye, what was your plan?
Part of me wonders if he even had one.
He was just seeing how
Like,
it
part of me wonders if this is like a Marcion Rowe situation where he has like one goal in mind, but how he gets there is like distinctively up to what he decides in the moment, I think, or what events play out that eventually get him to that event. Does that make sense? Like Marcion, see, I'm switching. Marcion like wants to end the Jedi, and then he doesn't have a direct plan. He's just like, okay, well then we'll do this, and then this will happen, and then I guess this will happen. But he's not thinking multiple steps ahead, and I feel like that's the vibe that I got from Chimer. He was kind of letting Osha decide in a way. He did give her the option. Like the option was put he put all of this out onto a table before them both and was like, this, this, and this, and this, this, and this, and then you decide. And go ahead. You have a thought. Brewing. Cooking.
Well, I think that OSHA, because at the end, OSHA is like, oh, if you let my sister grow, then I will train with you. And we don't, Chimer doesn't really give much reaction to that. I wonder if he was even planning on keeping May, like, or doing anything with May after OSHA was like with him.
Yeah.
I think that as soon as May kind of showed that she wasn't capable in episode, what was it, four or five, he
yeah.
was like, okay.
Four, I think.
He kind of pulled back. So I wonder if he was even going to do anything with her at all. And if OSHA had to be worried about that at all, like, oh, let my sister go and I'll train with you. Like, I don't know if he intended to do anything to May, because especially because it seemed like he was leaning towards OSHA. And I'm sure that if he had hurt May, OSHA would not have been on his side at all anymore. And so I think that he just was quiet because, okay, let her think that, like, that I need to let her go and she'll come with me kind of thing. So yeah, I think that as soon as he had OSHA on that island and kind of felt out like who she was as a person and kind of got an idea of her, that kind of solidified it for him, especially because he offered to train her before he even went to Brandok with her to find May, because that kind of tells me that he had switched up and wanted OSHA to be his acolyte before they even saw that if May was going to be able to kill the Jedi without a weapon or not.
Yeah.
So
Interesting.
I think he had already decided that OSHA was going to be the person that he was going to put all his eggs in one basket for, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I want to go back to the beginning scene, the opening scene. I loved that it immediately started where episode 7 ends, because 8 was the flashback.
No, 6. Because 7
Oh,
was the flashback.
Okay, that's right. Thank you. And OSHA ultimately decided when Chimer left the room that she was going to put on the helmet. So I think, so it dulls all of your senses. We learned that in episode 6. So I feel like what was happening was the same magic that her mother was using, because Chimer's eyes were black, like Torben's. So I wonder if OSHA having all of her senses dulled kind of like allowed her to open up basically that third eye, or that quote unquote dark side of the Force that she has always had in her, I suppose. I don't know. It was a very similar situation with Torben. The only thing was, the difference was that Chimer was actively fighting against it, unlike Torben. And not fighting against it in the way where he didn't want to be there, but to help her, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I loved the reflection of her saber, or soul saber, turning red in her eyes. At first I thought her eyes were red, but it was the literal
the vision
reflection. Yeah. And not to jump around so much, but the bleeding of it was just done so poetically well. Like, the fact that she broke her master saber and then was going to use it against him, but ultimately didn't, because she ended up choking him. But then she bleeds her master saber red, and seeing it ignited first. And Leslie Headland said in an interview that I just read right before we hopped on, was that this specific saber had to be blue. And I just loved that choice.
Yes.
I thought it was a great idea.
I think the effect wouldn't have been the same if it had been any other color, because blue is so juxtaposed to red visually. I don't think it would have had as much of an impact.
If it had been yellow or green. It's like Indara's being green and being ignited in episode 7 when she's coming to fight against Kelnaka. I remember that Charlie Barnett and Daphne Keene both said that they couldn't choose the color of their sabers, that it was given to them. And I feel like the saber colors like do match their characters very well. And not just Yord and Jeki, but like all of the Jedi.
Yeah, I agree. And here's another poetic visual to put out there. Sol offered his saber to Osha when he first met her on Brendok, in that same courtyard, in that same spot, like literally steps away from that exact same spot where he first offered the lightsaber to her, and she took it from him to hold it. In that exact same spot, 16 years later, she takes the lightsaber, picks it up, and it becomes hers, and she bleeds it there in the exact same spot. Like that, I love that. I love that so much. And the fact that she didn't kill him with the lightsaber, she use the force, and like you don't know that it's her doing it at first. I mean, you kind of get the sense, but at the very, very first few seconds, you don't know. And then she lifts her hand and it's like, oh gosh. And Chimer, I don't think, realized at the very first seconds either.
No.
And then it's like, oh, this is what's happening. And I mean, the devastation of realizing that this person that you loved and cared about had failed you so spectacularly. And also, Osha thought that she failed. She's the one, she thought that she had failed, but she was kind of set up for failure when she went through such a traumatic event and then was taken to become a Jedi. And no wonder she couldn't get over what happened to her. She had been lied to about it, and always, I think, always knew in the back of her mind that something wasn't right, and just probably didn't even want to go there. And I think it was Chimer was alluding to, like, you don't really know who your master is and what he's done. And then when she gets a second to question Sol, and she's like, what do you mean? What did he mean by that? And Sol had even told her that he had something to tell her. So she already kind of knew there was something wrong. And then how May had kind of alluded to it. So she already kind of knew that this could be true, but she didn't know what was true. And then that it was like, oh, he killed our mother. May is like, I didn't do this. It was all a lie. The devastation of that, I can imagine, was just so great that it's like, of course, Osha didn't want to hear anything. She didn't want to hear Sol's explanation or his excuses or whatever, you know. And she was so emotional. Like she even kind of frightened May in their little fight before courtyard. Like she was upset, and May was even a little shaken by it, because I don't think that May had the same rage.
No, that's the really sad part. And I think that I said this in our last coverage episode that a relationship, I think this is from Spider-Man, a relationship built off of this dishonesty is always destined to fail or something like that. But I the sad part about Sol, the tragic part about his character is that he knew that he was wrong, but he was so I'm trying to think about it. He was so determined to for it to seem like it was justified in a way. In his own mind, he has this narrative that the girls were in danger and that what he was doing was saving them. And that's the thing, is that the amount of miscommunication that happened that night, specifically with what May said on the ship to Indara and Sol about how it could be the sacrifice, but she had said something, she had said it incorrectly. So in Sol's mind, he still believes 16 years later that the girls were going to be sacrificed. So I think that this is a really interesting display of the love versus attachments in the Jedi Order, I suppose, like if we're looking at it from a very narrow perspective. But Sol is about to blatantly admit that he loves Osha, and he formed a dangerous attachment to her. And it was just very, very interesting. Like, his character is so tragic, and I wasn't expecting him to die. And I think that Osha being the one to kill him, and it's the first time that this is the manifestation of the Force coming back to her in a way, and it's to kill her master. I don't know. It was just so intense. It was such a sad, sad death, because Sol literally looks her in the eye and says, "It's okay." And he literally spoke himself to death, to the point where Osha didn't know any other way to shut him up besides to kill him, because he was not going to accept any other narrative. And the other narrative was the truth.
Yeah.
Which is the really sad part. And I will say that I don't think that Sol deserved to die. I think that it's really sad that he did, and it happened for the story. But I'm not going to, like, I'm still not going to call the Jedi bad, because they're not bad. Like, he yeah. made a very, very, very human mistake. And that's the effect of miscommunication, is that it leads to mistakes and betrayal and, yeah.
And sort of a pride in a sense too, because he wouldn't admit, he barely was able to get it out there that he killed her mother. Like, he was barely able to admit it
yeah.
out there.
Because
he didn't want it to feel, because he always wanted it to be justified in his mind what he did. And I think that this is a very good example of everything that the Jedi tried to teach their students and their other Jedi, like trying to get across to them that this is the path that you could walk. Like, these mistakes can happen if you don't temper your emotions, if you don't temper your attachments, if you're not introspective, if you don't take a step back, if you don't really think, if you don't see things from other people's point of view. Like, Indara had been trying to tell Sol throughout the whole flashback episode, like, other cultures do these kinds of things, like, we don't have all the whole story, you know. She'd been trying to get him to take a step back, and he wouldn't, because he just latched on to this narrative that turned out to be not completely true. And that fallout led to his death. And like you said, I don't think Jedi bad. I just think that institutions fail.
Yeah.
People in institutions fail. And that this story needed to be told to better understand how the Jedi Order fell in Revenge of the Sith, like how we get to that point, like the way that the Jedi have kind of left their ideals behind,
yeah.
or not they're not manifesting them in the way that they originally like wanted to. And I think that, yeah, I just think that that's, we see the consequences of that with Sol.
Yeah. Well, I'm I'm looking at the scene now, and May says, I want you to admit your crimes to the Senate, to the Republic. And Sol doesn't even respond to that. He immediately goes back to saying, you and Osha are the same person. And he talks about how, the virgins is the cause of, how their mother was able to do that, and how he says, I believe she used the force to create you and Osha, and blah blah blah. And there's a very interesting moment where the camera goes to Chimer, and I don't know, I don't want to think too much into it, but I wonder if he knew somehow, and that was how him and May met, and because he knew that Osha was Osha the moment that he met her. He says, like, you look just like her. So he knows that she had a twin or a sister. So it, I don't know, but it also goes back to Sol just actively denying or being unable to admit both to himself and to May that he did kill Anisea. Like he doesn't, like she's asking him to admit his crimes, and he is still blurting out his own narrative because he's so convinced in his own mind that what he did was the right thing. I think also one of my favorite things is that Chimer hangs back. Chimer does not intervene. Like, he does fight Sol one-on-one because the girls aren't there. But like the moment that Osha and May enter in, like he takes a step back and he lets it unfold.
Yeah. I liked that. I like that Chimer, we can't really put Chimer in a box. I mean, yeah, he's bad, but we don't really know what flavor or what his intentions are. So I won't make excuses for his actions, but at the same time, he does operate very uniquely as a villain. We think of villains as these violent, self-serving people. But in this sense, I feel like either Chimer has more, I don't want to say empathy, or maybe it's just patience. Maybe he just wants to see how things are going to unfold. So he just doesn't. I think he had a sense that Sol was going to sow the seeds of his own downfall in that set in that moment, and he wanted to see it play out. And so why interfere? Why interject when it was all going to happen right in front of his eyes in those moments? So, but I agree. I like that he just kind of was letting it happen. But I don't know that he had any idea of how exactly it would unfold either, because, he knows that there was a vision that needed to be fulfilled or was going to happen. So
Yeah, I find it also very interesting how he reacts to when Vernestra senses him on the planet. I see the line still jumps out to me where he says it was a long time ago. There's too much emphasis on that one line that he says to Osha in episode six, where I'm like, what does that mean? And a lot of people have a couple of theories, and I found it really interesting with how Chimer responded to Vernestra landing on the planet and them first sensing each other. He was so quick to put on his helmet to block her out, but also the connection that they had instantly. It was
yeah.
so strong. It was instant. Like, the moment she sets foot on that planet, she's connected to Chimer once again. And she says that he's alive, and it shocks her. And it was one of my first, like, the moment we saw the scars in episode six, and then we had that very prominent shot of Vernestra's light whip, which I don't think was I do think that it was intentional to show us the scars and then the light whip, but I think that there was a connection. I think that she says, like, he was my pupil before he turned evil. And I feel like season two is going to explore that a little bit more if there is a season two. But I want to know more about their relationship.
Well, if we do get a season two, I was thinking that it'd be interesting if they kept with this formula of flashbacks and they gave us flashback episodes about Chimera's past,
Yeah, that'd be really
the way
cool.
they did with Osha and Sol. It'd be like Chimera and Vernestra. I think that that would be pretty interesting. Yeah. And another reason why I would like to see it is because if we get flashbacks to Vernestra and Sol, or not Vernestra and Sol. If we get flashbacks to Vernestra and Chimera as master and apprentice, we could get Vernestra mentioning Stellagios. So that's why I want to see it.
I feel like this opens up such a can of worms because it's been something that I've been thinking about since the episode. Honestly, since episode six dropped, it hasn't been able to leave my brain. But Stellan's lineage now currently being at a point where there is a Sith in it, in a way, makes a lot of sense to me. And when I say that, I'm not blaming it on Stellan because Stellan was, I think, an excellent master to Vernestra and any of the resources that he used towards teaching her was, I think, the best that he possibly could do despite the circumstances of the era where she was his Padawan. And I even say that after she hits knighthood because she comes to Stellan at multiple points. She comes to Stellan and out of the shadows, and there's that moment where Stellan knows about the visions. I feel like their connection was a bit deeper than what we might have seen so blatantly than what we saw with like Nib and Buryaga and Indara and excuse me, Indira and Bell. I talked about this online, but let me reference it so I don't mess it up. Savvy going on a Stellan tangent in an episode is a very likely thing to happen, but I feel like it is a conversation that has to be had. But I said Stellan's lineage ending with a, and by ending, I mean I meant currently being. I just said it weird. It's a reflection. I said it does not directly reflect on Stellan nor Vernestra as masters. It's a reflection of the system, so the Jedi Order and the events. So, you know, Valo, Stellan becoming Marshal, Vernestra, you know, going on all of these missions and going through all of these visions, and Stellan going through the investigation of the Nameless Murders and blah, blah, blah. It was a reflection of the system and events during the time they were active that failed to allow the lineage to bloom properly. So I can't stress enough that Stellan was not a bad master. Because if Stellan was a bad master, who in that time period was good? He did the best that he could despite the circumstances and taught Vernestra to the best of his abilities. And there are so many instances where Padawans fall to the dark side. For example, Imri. And I don't know, like, it just makes sense to me.
And I think people put a lot more emphasis on the optics of Stellan than needs be. And I think that's one reason why Stellan dies or comes to an end, because he never wanted the responsibility and the spotlight that was put on him. He kind of just rose to the occasion because he felt like he needed to. So people putting Stellan on a pedestal, like fans and everything who know about Stellan, who put him on this pedestal of like, well, you know, if Vernestra's Padawan turned to the dark side, that's a reflection on Stellan. Stop.
Yeah.
It's stop perpetuating the same, like, sort of, I'm going to use the word toxicity that kind of led Stellan to become so stressed out and, you know, having like these near breakdowns near the end of his life because everybody was putting him on a pedestal. Let's leave Stellan alone. If Chimer fell to the dark side because of any sort of training, it would be on Vernestra. Like, this would be on Vernestra if we're going to even blame the master at all. Like, Chimer is responsible for his own actions. So yeah, Vernestra probably maybe had a hand in it. So let's everybody, if we're going to blame a master, blame Vernestra, not Stellan. And Vernestra became a knight at like 15. And this was before the events of Hetzel. So there wasn't any conflict happening. So I'm sure that her demonstrations of skill, everybody was like, oh yeah, sure, let's let her be a knight. You know, nothing's going on. It's not like there's anything, you know, we'll just let her come into her own. But yeah, let's make her a knight because she's so great. So I think that a lot of people are like, oh, Vernestra was knighted at 15. I don't know if that was the right choice. And yeah, we can discuss that, but it wasn't like the council fast-tracked her knighthood because of a crisis or anything like that. She earned that. And I think that it's almost like a non-point, I guess, against her, you know? And because she was a prodigy and she came into her own, and we see her constantly reflecting on that throughout the first book that she was in and throughout the rest of the phases or phase. Basically, what I'm trying to say is that any of Vernestra's failings are in her own mind, and she is the one who has sort of sabotaged herself if there's anything going on. Like, I think that she, I don't know, delete all that. I don't know what I'm saying.
No, I think I know where you're going with this. I was thinking about this while you were talking. I think you had said it where it was like, if there's anyone to blame, blame for Nestra. But I feel like I don't disagree with you, but I also feel like the main aspect to blame of the situation is the institution, so the Jedi Order.
Yes.
I feel like because And this is like going off of what you said, because that Vernestra was knighted so young and given a Padawan at such a young age, that is where the institution failed her. I feel like Stellan was so confident in her abilities, and that's not wrong of Stellan to be confident in the child that he taught to be knighted. I think that that's what the where the sadness, I guess, or where like the poignancy comes from is that I don't know if Ra'na Selyn's master was a prodigy. And Eivar says this line in Temptation of the Force where she says, "A prodigy can only teach a prodigy." And I don't know if Ra'na, and this is not me blaming Ra'na at all, because maybe she didn't know that Stellan was a prodigy at the time. But that's the thing about gifted children is that they're often not given the proper resources to be able to succeed in an ability that is healthy. And I feel like Stellan, there are so many instances where Stellan proves himself to be such an excellent master even after he's gone. I One of the moments that truly sticks out to me the most is chapter 40 of Defy the Storm, where Vernestra speaks to Elzar and is able to get past the 6-inch thick wall that Elzar has put up, that nobody would have been able to knock down except Eivar or Stellan. And I think that, and Eivar wasn't there. And Vernestra was having all of these thoughts to herself, where basically, like, she was saying she doesn't know how Stellan could even be friends with a man like this, and blah, blah, blah. But she was saying stuff that was getting beyond, that was like punching a hole through those walls that Elzar had up. And that was one of the moments that really stood out to me the most. And then another one in Defy the Storm was when she lets Imri go. And I those are all the moments where I see Stellan in her, and all the moments where I'm like, Stellan did the best that he possibly could have done despite the circumstances.
And to your point, and how we were talking about before, Stellan was also in a sense a victim of the institution as well, because he was accepting all of this responsibility and stress because he was trying to live up to the expectations, or even unspoken expectations and optics that the council was projecting onto him, and the Senate and the entirety of the Republic, and he was trying to live up to that, and Vernestra likewise was trying to do that in some cases as well, trying to live up to this expectation that she was worthy of knighthood, because they said she was.
Yeah.
That she deserved it and should be a knight because they said that she was. But we have to go, okay, but was she? And then that gets in her head the way that it got into Stellan's head. And at the end, all he wanted to be was just himself instead of this mantle that had been placed on him. So I see what you're saying. The point that I was trying to get to is that as Vernestra grows up and matures and becomes an adult, how did she process that, and how did she apply that burden of knighthood going into her adult years? When does she become a master? When does like all this occur for her, and how does she deal with it, and how does she go forth with her life between phase 3 and the Acolyte to get to the kind of person that she is in the Acolyte?
Yeah.
Because there comes a point where she's responsible for herself and for the way that she is. And this isn't to say that Vernestra is a bad person.
No.
But trying to understand her character and to get where she's at, I think that the end of phase 3 will give us maybe some more insight into that. Because we can already see that she's the kind of person that she's becoming. I feel like you get a little bit of a glimpse of that in Temptation of the Force.
Yeah.
And I almost wonder if she became this person that covers up for the Jedi because of things that had happened with the Nile.
Yeah.
And what happens at the end, which we don't know what happens yet.
I think that it's okay to hold Vernestra a little bit accountable. Yeah. And I think that it's also okay to hold Stellan a little bit accountable. Was there something that he could have put more thought into about Vernestra becoming a knight at 14 years old? Yes. I think that maybe he could have taken a step back and been like, well, I feel confident, but does Vernestra feel confident? And I think that that's not his fault. I think that he was just going with what he thought was the right thing for his Padawan. And I think there are so many instances. The show is about that. I don't know. I think that what Vernestra did this season at the end, because now we can finally go back to the Acolyte. I think this is a good leeway back into it. What Vernestra did at the end, using Master Soul to cover up what went down, is something that is not just what Vernestra has done. We saw it with Krayton's son in Cataclysm with the Nameless. And I'm sure we'll see it again at the end of Temptation of the Force or something like that. Oh, not Temptation of the Force. The next adult novel, or with, I mean, look at Aslan Rel. Hidden away from the council for so long. And so I can't necessarily blame Vernestra for trying to cover it up. She also was thinking about what was best for the order as a whole, because now she has the senator coming in and telling her that there's going to be this meeting against the Jedi, essentially. I don't remember exactly what was said, but I don't know. So does it suck that Master Sol, his image was blatantly destroyed by a lie that Vernestra was using to cover up? Yes. But do I think that she's going to make things right through and with May? Yes. Also, that is quoting Rebecca, who plays Vernestra, so I think that that is going to come, hopefully. But I don't know. I think that Vernestra is a now very complex, and I think I'm using this word right, but nuanced character. And I think that saying, like, trying to compare her to the books is almost doing her an injustice because it's been 100 years. I'm a different person than I was 2 years ago. Can you imagine 100 years later how
Yeah.
you would be, and
Yeah.
all that you've seen?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I don't have any negative thoughts towards Vernestra. Like, I
Yeah.
love a complex character. I love seeing them make choices that I go, oh, my goodness. You know, it doesn't make me dislike her. I almost like her more for the fact that we get this complexity and this messiness with her, with Soul, with every character in this show. Nothing is cut and dry. And I think that's what makes this show so great, is because it gets us talking about these nuances.
Yeah.
And I don't know that there is, I feel like there is a right and a wrong. But you'll go, oh, it's not right. Like, it really sucks that she decided to make him the scapegoat. And then you'll go, well, he shouldn't have killed Anisea to begin with. You know, it just all kind of rolls back to those first mistakes. And then now you're seeing all these consequences roll out from those first miscommunications and first missteps in this series. And that's why, like, how we talked earlier about how this show started in the light, I almost feel like it couldn't end in the light again, because we get the sense that something has gone very wrong, and we don't get gone very wrong for the Jedi.
Yeah.
Like, they made a mistake. They're being killed out of revenge. What did they do? Now we see what they did.
Yeah.
So I don't know that there could have ever been like a light side ending to this season.
Yeah. I don't think so either. I think that when episode 5 happened, that was the turning point. That was the okay, you guys were all your theories about this ending with a happy ending and Osha, you know, joining the light side and going back to the Jedi, if that was your theory, then completely thrown out the window. I liked that narratively about it. I thought that that was a really interesting way to bring in a very complex story about somebody. It reminds me a lot of what Kylo says to Rey when he says to kill, like, kill the past if you have to. Osha literally kills the past.
Yeah.
Osha
Yeah.
literally kills the past. And I, in a way, I'm almost a little happy for her. Not
Yeah.
in the sense that she, you know, killed Sol. That's not what I'm happy about. I'm happy that she was finally able to let go. In a way, her whole life, 16 years of not knowing, of being lied to, even when not actively there. And being traumatized by this one event in her life that she never got the correct answer to, which was the truth.
And she ended it where it began, in that exact spot. She took revenge for her mother, where her mother died. And I want to zoom out a little bit on this and talk about how Darth Plagueis makes an appearance in the cave. We don't know if Chimer is aware that he's there. I would assume he is aware, but also because there's moments where he kind of has this like look on his face, specifically at the very beginning of the episode when Osha tells him about the vision and he like stands up and turns around and looks away from her. He looks really distraught and kind of like something is bothering him. And I was kind of suspicious of that. And then the other point was what you brought up earlier when Sol is telling May about how she and Osha are not sisters, that they were created with the Force. And there's that look that Chimer has. I almost wonder if him and Plagueis are working together, and that this whole season, this whole story, specifically about the twins, is what inspires Plagueis to be able to try to create life with the Force. It's them that inspires him. I think that that could be the case, or going a little bit more deeper into that, did Plagueis know about them? Did he have anything to do with Anisea and Coral? Was there any connection between Anisea, Coral, and Plagueis in terms of like how they created Osha and May? That one I don't really believe as much, but that's just my wonderings there. And it adds a new layer to the tragedy of Darth Plagueis. This also being a tragedy, the Acolyte also being, in a sense, a tragedy for, like, Sol and for May and Osha, their mother being killed at the beginning, or, in when they were 8. I would have never expected the Acolyte to be the origin story of how Darth Plagueis learns how to create life with the Force. But I think that's what it is. I think that's what this is leading to, is that explanation.
Yeah, that is very possible, I think, and I want to kind of rewind back also where to the episode where Ki-Adi-Mundi shows up and how he's kind of involved with the whole situation about Osha and May, or at least he hears about it. But then he's also the one that says in the prequel trilogy that the Sith have been extinct for millennia or millennium. That makes so much sense to me, even more so after the finale. Burnestra covers up the story.
There you go.
Again, I'm going to bring up the Interview with the Vampire line, but letting the tale seduce you. I feel like people are so easily susceptible to wanting answers now, but the mystery and the fantastic aspect of such narrative storytelling like the Acolyte is that there has to be patience to get to the I think I said this once before in one of our review episodes, is that when I don't know if any of our listeners have watched CSI, but I used to be obsessed with CSI Las Vegas. Like, that was my 911. That was my Grey's Anatomy. It was CSI Las Vegas. And every episode of CSI Las Vegas, there is a murder at the beginning or whatever happens at the beginning. And then throughout the entire episode, there's multiple different aspects of the crime scene investigators group. So there's like the forensics, there's the field workers, there's the autopsy group and things like that. But all of them are having different opinions and different conclusions. And then there are the outside forces that are working, and there's not one path to the final scene where the murderer is revealed. There's always branches coming off of the main path, and there's always loops where they go back to the beginning and they have to work through it again. So I don't know, maybe when I was first watching The Acolyte and it was presented to me as a murder mystery, I was like, okay, we're gonna hit that at the end, like that's gonna be the last possible reveal, who we find out murders whoever. So yeah, I don't know. That was another tangent, but I feel like people are not letting the tale seduce them in a way, and I wish that people did. I feel like that they would enjoy the story a lot more, because Star Wars is not linear. Star Wars has never been linear. The stories are all told out of order. We're getting The High Republic now, which is centuries before the prequels, and it's been so long since the early 2000s, and now we're just getting an explanation, and now we're just getting a bridge, and that's okay. Like that's good. I feel, can you imagine how people felt in 1977? Is that when the first one came out, 1977? Sitting in a movie theater hearing Obi-Wan Kenobi say the Clone Wars. Can you imagine how they felt? And then to like 2006, Attack of the Clones?
2002,
that's when they got their answer. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, I'm totally with you. I'm totally with you, sister. I think that people are just demanding too much of these storytellers, and they should just chill and they can have their theories, but like, don't get upset. Like, we can have our you know, we can critique the pacing, we can critique the certain ways that characters are portrayed and their decisions are portrayed, but all in all, laying out the story, laying out the plot and all the narrative beats of this, I don't see anything to be upset about. And if people are like, but what about this or what about that? It's like, well, then season two. Like, just let it be. Enjoy it. Have fun. It's Star Wars. Like,
Star Wars is supposed to be fun. Sorry, continue.
No, it's fake and in space, and yes, it has stuff to tell us that are important about that you can equate to real life situations, but nobody should be taking it so seriously that they're getting all up in arms and angry about it. I think that The Acolyte gave us a lot to ruminate on. It gave us answers, it gave us more questions, and I feel like that's a good thing to be left with. And yeah, Oshimir girlies, I'm so happy for you. I count myself among you. I like a good enemies to lovers plot. So I will be enjoying it in the interim. And I think they did it so well too, because I was a little bit hesitant at the beginning. I was like, he just killed friends.
I was also really hesitant. I remember, because we were talking about writing something together, and I was like, I don't know if I'm ready.
Yeah, and so I was like, I don't know, but I think they did it so well in this last episode. I'm sorry, yeah. Like, I, Chimere, yeah.
I love that there was no kiss. I think that's what I was really afraid about, where I was like, she just made this decision. She just went through this horrible, horrible moment. And Chimer, being the man that he is underneath all of that cortosis, is so willing for her to let her make her own decisions that he waited to step closer to her until she gave him the permission with her eyes and expression there at the end. And then he came closer and then he put his hand on hers. Yeah. That's where I'm also like, Stellan and Vernestra were good masters because of how Chimer is. Chimer is respectful. He may be a murderer, but he's respectful.
He was respectful. He was caring. He, I don't know, maybe I'm just being brainwashed by him, but
I don't think
I really think that he is a very complex character. And I think it probably all goes back to what happened to him. He had been a Jedi. He had been Vernestra's Padawan. What happened that led him down this dark path? What led him to be like, how did he get that scar? If it was from Vernestra's light whip, like what could have happened that would do that? And I do have a suspicion that it has to do with attachment, that it has to do with, which is pretty much the case with every Jedi that goes astray. I think it really does have to do with that. Like, Chimer probably had a relationship or a love or an attachment for somebody or something, and that led him down a path that diverted from the Jedi's. And so, yeah, I'm interested to know what that is. And yeah, I can't forgive him for killing Yord and Jeki. I'm not going to be like, come here, it's okay. They deserved it. No, they didn't deserve it.
They didn't deserve it, yeah.
And I don't think that he killed them out of, like, and he kind of says this to Osha, like, they were Jedi that were attacking him. He killed them. Like, it doesn't go any deeper than that for him. And, I mean, yeah, so there's that, but
yeah,
justice for them, hopefully, eventually.
I think that they'll get that justice that they deserve. I think that I do sometimes get a little sad that we didn't get to see like Jackie's reaction to the truth. Or Yord's, like, I would have loved to see how they could have had a hand in that. But I do think that it was very brave of Leslie Headland and the rest of the writers to kind of take that jump into killing major characters. And I think that it was really, like, I have to applaud them for that because it was so depressing. Like, I felt like I lost a friend. But speaking of Jackie's death, because it reminded me of Chimer's lightsaber, I really want to talk about that lightsaber. That is also so Vernestra Roe of him to have a lightsaber that's out of the ordinary. Not to compare, I don't know. It was so good. The way that it's a Shoto blade, but it still connects to one. I think that is just beautiful. And I'm so happy that the prop department let Leslie Headland do it, because that is one of the coolest lightsabers I have ever seen.
And I heard that it was sort of inspired by Manny's culture.
Yes, he's Filipino. And I love that. Star Wars is inspired by so many different cultures. So bringing in somebody's culture who's playing a specific character, I think that's so cool. Also with Cassian. Cassian is a character that is being told this story of an immigrant story, which directly reflects a lot of immigrant stories. I was actually talking to some friends about this over the weekend that I had gone to go see in Portland, not to get off on a Cassian tangent, but we were talking about culture and Star Wars. So we were talking about Marva, and I was like, as a fan of Star Wars and as a casual viewer, I like Marva. Marva hypes me up. Marva's story excites me that she stood up to the Empire so magnificently. But then, as an immigrant's child, I don't like Marva. So I think that there's a lot of different views. Whoa, way off tangent. But I love that for Manny. That was really cool. I really wanted to talk about this interview that he just did with GQ, where he brings up how he was a little afraid, I guess, when he took this role, that it wasn't going to advance his career because a lot of people of color in Hollywood have a very difficult time be in their careers further advancing. And a perfect example is Dev Patel writing and directing and acting in Monkey Man because he wasn't being hired to do any action films. And it's even said in Monkey Man that he is, I think it's like Brown John Wick or something like that, and Indian John Wick. And I love that there was like that sense of the call out in the movie. And even then, Monkey Man was going to be shelved. So I love that he used this interview at the end of The Acolyte to advance on that. I love Manny Jacinto. I didn't, I was unfamiliar with his game. I didn't even know that he was in Top Gun because he said in the interview that all of his lines were removed.
Yeah, he said, you might know me from the 15 seconds I was in Top Gun, Maverick.
Yeah.
I was like, that's kind of a little bit of a call out, but like deserved call out.
Yeah.
Like,
Also, Adriana Arjona, a brown woman, a Latina, says that for the first time in Hitman, she feels like she finally was able to give some creative direction and have some creative freedom on a character. So I feel like that also leads into like being able to, like, these people should be able to properly express themselves and their culture and have a say. You know what I mean? Like I am actually really. This all kind of leads back to being able to use his culture in his saber or express that culture in his saber. I think that that is a small step, but I think that it was a very, there was importance to it.
This is another point I'll make. Star Wars has always pulled from different cultures, but
Yeah.
I feel like it hasn't been represented by the people of those cultures
Yeah.
historically.
Well,
A very prominent example that just comes to mind is Princess Leia's buns and her hairstyles being inspired by First Nations people's hairstyles, but Carrie Fisher was not a First Nations woman.
Mon Mothma at the end of Andor is literally wearing Asian-inspired robes.
Yes, exactly. And so I like when you can see those people's culture represented by those people, instead of just their cultures being represented, but not by them. And I think that it's not just a Star Wars thing. It's happened in so many different forms of media that they've been, different cultural aspects have been pulled and used, but not actually represented by those people. And so I feel like with Manny and with that lightsaber and combat style, that's showing it, like that's his culture and
Yeah.
he gets to represent it. And I want to see more of that going forward in Star Wars and every form of media, not just Star Wars. And I think this is a good step in that direction. And so yeah, that's like how we've been talking. Like I really loved that part of The Acolyte. It's like people can go, oh, I recognize that. That's me, like that's my culture.
I think we talked about this with Zoraida Cordova, not to flex on that interview, but that does exist. Rosario Dawson is a Cuban woman, and you know this, I am so immensely proud being Cuban. I love being Cuban. I love my culture. I love how I grew up on it. I love like the people of my culture. I love that I've been able to make friends, like other Latino friends, and blah blah blah. And I've been able to share my culture with you. Like you've come over and you've experienced my family and the food and the music. And knowing that Ahsoka was played by a Cuban woman automatically. And I know that Cuba doesn't exist in Star Wars, but I was like, Ahsoka is Cuban. Ahsoka is Afro-Latina, and I look at the episode in Tales of the Jedi so fondly when Ahsoka is a baby, and her mother is also voiced by, I think, the same woman who plays Edyn Verso, who is also, I believe, a Latina woman. And so it just has that connection. And I grew up, one of my first introductions to Star Wars outside of the original trilogy was the Clone Wars. And Ahsoka was like, I grew up with Ahsoka. I was this a very similar age and a little bit younger than her. And now that I'm an adult and this Cuban woman has been casted as her, and in Tales of the Jedi, she has this mother and this father who love her so intimately and lovingly, and they teach her like how to defend herself and this independence, and that you can do anything. Be and it just reminds me of, sorry, we're going off on this
No,
tangent.
please.
It just reminds me about how my mom raised me and my sisters, about how, like, if our family can come from Cuba to the United States and like go out and go get something that was not accessible, and we only came here with a suitcase, like you can do this too. Like Ahsoka's mom taught her that she can go against a large creature. And I feel like that scene to me was so symbolic, because sometimes life for immigrants and immigrant children is a large creature. It's like, I don't know. I know I'm going off on this tangent.
Girl, you're making me cry.
Really?
Well, it's so beautiful. And that really speaks to how Star Wars has evolved in such a positive way to be
Yeah.
able to offer this to you and others like you. Like that just makes me so emotional, and I really love that. I love that so much.
It is so emotional. And my mom, I'm so sorry for saying so much about my mom.
No, I love your mom.
I'm not trying to dox my mom.
Savi's mom, guys, Savi's mom is like one of the best people I've ever met in my entire life.
My mom is my Sir Jundah. Like, my mom is my Silencios. My mom is Miss Tano, like the mom Tano. My mom was one of the first people that I had shared Andor with. I went to Star Wars Celebration in Anaheim, and I went to the Latino representation at Star Wars panel on the last day. And I forget who the creator was, but he said, he was like, Cassian is giving a voice to my family, or like, Cassian is my family. I directly remember that quote, because it felt like he had imprinted that on my head, because I was like, Cassian is my family. My mom left a sister behind, and unfortunately that sister had passed away, but Cassian left a sister behind, and I was like, this is my mom, this is my family. And there is backlash that Diego has gotten, and there's backlash that Tony Gilroy has gotten. But sitting down and being able to watch Andor with my mom, and have this immigrant woman who came to the United States to make the family that she didn't even know she was going to have yet have a better future than her past. Like the fact that she can sit down and watch Andor and see herself in this, that is so meaningful.
Yeah, I'm still here silently crying.
The scene where Cassian makes all of this money and he doesn't even think about himself. He thinks about Marva. Every Latin American Latino child knows that feeling, how that feels. And I guess I don't want to speak for all of them, but a lot of us know how that feels. So I guess I'll end on that. But yeah, it's a really, really, really beautiful story. All of it. And I mean that with all of Star Wars. And Manny Jacinto playing Chimaire, who is a bad guy, quote unquote, but is kind and soft and patient and understanding and loving. That is so important.
And I feel like when we got Chimaire's sort of like alter ego, Chimaire, at the beginning of the season, I don't want to say that. I mean, I know he was being duplicitous.
Yeah.
But I feel like that version of him was also not completely not him. Like, I feel like there's parts of that person he was playing that is also Chimaire, like, truly.
Yeah.
Because I feel like you can't be that duplicitous without also having, like, when he was being softer with May and like talking to her and trying to understand her, you still see bits and pieces of that with him and Osha. So I think that he's not a complete, like, we know he's lied, but I don't think that he's a complete two-faced person in that sense.
Yeah, I don't think so either at all.
I almost feel like his darker, eviler side is not an act, but I just almost wonder which is more truly him. Which side of him is more truly him? Is he vicious and dark and acting evil because that's truly what he wants and who he is? Or is it how he has, the point that he's fallen to, like the end of his rope, or like the furthest, you know, when you're like with Osha, her ultimate act of darkness was to kill Sol. But when she's out of that situation, she's not that angry person constantly all the time,
no,
showing that. You know what I'm saying? So I almost wonder if Chimaire's extreme evil and darkness is not truly his middle ground, like who he really is as a person. And this is not me making excuses for his evil acts. Like, you could say the same thing with Sol.
Yeah.
You know, his ultimate act of his mistake was not truly him at his core. And the same with Vernestra, blaming Sol, having him be the scapegoat. She's not always that dark person, or what I say, like, lying or covering up. That's not who she truly is.
Yeah.
And that's not to make excuses for all of those things, but it's just to say that I think there's more to Chimaire than we've really seen. And I'm excited to see more of that. And also more of Osha, more of everybody. Yeah.
It reminds me a lot of what Comec Vitus says to Reeth in Into the Dark, when Reeth asks Comec if he could please become his master after he loses Jorah. And Comec is at first a little bit hesitant, but then he says, I feel like we both have something to teach each other. And I feel like that's going to be Osha and Chimaire, in my opinion. I think that Osha is going to teach Chimaire as much as Chimaire is going to teach Osha. And also, Chimaire is not telling Osha to go out and, you know, go on a murder spree and kill everyone that she finds. He's telling her to accept her emotions and to open up and like let herself feel them, which that's not necessarily a bad thing. And
Yeah.
I guess I can reiterate that I know that Chimera did kill like Yord and Jeki and the rest of the Jedi, but he also has this own narrative in his head that the Jedi are something so bad had to have happened that this man felt like the only other way was the dark side. It's like with Anakin. It's like he
Yeah.
felt the only other way to save Padme was to fall to the dark side.
Aslan Rel probably
Yeah.
never expected himself to end up in the place that he did. And that's the tragedy
Yeah. Well,
of all these people.
that's another thing. I'm not extremely well knowledge about Greek mythology. I love mythological stories and tales like that, but a lot of them end in tragedy. And that's a thing is that I also feel like there is such a large influence on modern stories. And I think I told you this, but when I was teaching abroad, that was one of my students were very confused that I was teaching them about the Odyssey. But I was like, if it weren't for the Odyssey, then there wouldn't have been the hero's journey. And then if it weren't for the hero's journey, then we wouldn't have Star Wars. Because I use Star Wars as an example because the brain rot is that bad. But we wouldn't have Star Wars. We wouldn't have Lord of the Rings. We wouldn't have so many things if it weren't for that type of influence. But again, a lot of these stories end in tragedy. Achilles and Patroclus and Eurydice and Orpheus all end in tragedy. And Star Wars, a lot of the time, ends in tragedy. And I don't know, Rogue One ends in tragedy. So I think that it's well, I kind of applaud Dave Filoni a lot of the time in his stories because he blatantly puts his Norse mythology and Greek mythology right there out on display. Even with the Thrawn books, the Chimera is a beast in mythology, so it's there.
Yeah. And I think when people, there are people out there that go, Star Wars is supposed to be this and Star Wars this, but they always refer back to previous Star Wars content. I'm going to use the word content, but the previous Star Wars stories and plots and lore. And they go, well, it has to stick with this. It has to stick with that. But I don't think that we should gauge what Star Wars is off of what Star Wars has been. We should gauge Star Wars off of, or judge, I don't even say judge, but like Star Wars, like you're saying, is influenced by these other ancient stories, these classic stories, classic tropes. And I think that if we're gonna look at a story that Star Wars is telling us, we have to go, where have we seen this before in other media and other sources, and try to understand it through that lens instead of, well, Revenge of the Sith said this, or this book said this, so that means this can't be that. No, we need to zoom out and then examine it based off of these influences that we know Star Wars has taken from. And then I think people will better understand where it's going from there, or understand why certain choices were made off of that. And then, of course, these new stories are going to pull from pre-established things, you know,
Yeah.
Plagueis and stuff, but people shouldn't be caught up on the minutiae.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. You basically took the words right out of my mouth, or you put a period right at the end of that sentence.
Period.
I think what is really amazing about Star Wars and why I keep coming back to it and why you keep coming back to it is, and that how we've never really fallen out of love with it is because of all of the reasons that we said. is that it's ever changing and it's non-linear, and it's tragedy, but it's also love in the form of familial relationships and sacrifice and yada yada yada. Hope. That's the thing, is that Star Wars, like the core of Star Wars, is having hope, and us as human beings love to hold on to hope.
I would say hope and forgiveness is a huge, two huge pillars in my mind. When I think about Star Wars, I think about the hope for the future generations, the constant hope that someone can be redeemed and find their way back from a darker path to a lighter one. And I just, that is the core of Star Wars for me.
Yeah.
Is that light will prevail in any way that it can. And, yeah, and it only takes a little bit of light to cast out darkness. And we see that so often in these stories that Star Wars tells us, is that there only needs to be a little bit of light for a triumph to occur. And there will always be dark, but there's going to always be light. And so that's why we see these rises and falls, these ebbs and flows throughout Star Wars's timeline of this galaxy. And so I don't, there will never be like an ultimate win, an ultimate peace. There will never be an end to this story, because it's just like real life. There'll never be an ultimate winning, but that doesn't mean that the fight for light is doesn't have meaning or shouldn't be taken on. If anything, it's the more noble, obviously, it's a more noble path to make life better for people wherever and whenever you can, because darkness is always going to be there. So I just love that. And how you were saying, it's like Star Wars offers all of that to us. Like Star Wars offers everything that all these other stories in media offer us, is all in Star Wars as well. So that's another reason why I stay with it, is because I get all of that there too, in all different forms.
Yeah.
You know, books, visual media, music,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of music, Michael did a really great job this season. I hope that he returns for the next one. But it felt very like old black and white samurai filmy.
Yeah.
I loved that. It had a very, very interesting tone to it, and I loved it. But going off of what you said about it only takes a little bit of light, I kind of actually love that the final shot of Osha and Chimer was in the light. I don't know if the sun, I think that's the interesting part, is that we don't know if the sun was setting or rising. It's like,
yeah,
it's like the scene with Rey at the end of Tross, is that we don't know if the sun is setting. I know.
I'm getting chills.
It's like, I love that everything is so intricately thought out in this show, down to the lightsaber color, down to the color of the sky, like their clothes. Yeah, like Mei wearing the white and Osha wearing the black. I loved that. And also, I felt like Mei's outfit, excuse me, oh my gosh, I'm just like Master Soul. Osha's outfit for the first time felt like it was something that she wanted to wear. Because at the beginning of episode four, it was either the beginning of episode four or the end of episode four, where she said she didn't want to wear the civilian clothes. And that was mostly what she was wearing the whole time.
Yeah.
And then she's given this like outfit that fits her. It's like, it suits her personality in that. That's what I meant by fit. But I loved that. And the hood, it was so good. And Chimera. We got Chimera's poncho in the light, and I was just kind of obsessed with it. I was like, this is so good. I thought it was fabric, but it's like a rain poncho. Oh, the costumes are gonna go crazy with that one.
I love how kind of awkward it looks in the light, like in the forest in the dark. It was very scary. We talked about this, very scary. But when he's standing there at the tree with them at the end, he's just kind of just standing there in his helmet and his outfit. It just looks like it's not very intimidating anymore in that
No.
scene. And I think that that's very intentional,
Yeah,
because it kind of
intentional.
we know who Chimer is now, and so his outfit doesn't feel as scary as it did before. And I feel like I said, I feel like it was very intentional. Do we have any final thoughts about this finale? I have to say that I loved the scene with May and Osha under the tree, hugging, embracing each other. How May was so quick to accept having her memories erased for the sake of her sister and what her sister wants, because we start the series with them, with May not being able to let go of Osha and let Osha have what she wants, and we end with May letting her go and letting her have what she wants, which is so, oh my gosh, I'm getting chills just thinking about that. Like, May had this, I mean, had this character arc in a sense that
Yeah,
it's
it's
just all
very,
clicking. It's all clicking in my head
I
now as I say
know.
it out loud.
It's very, very beautiful. May, I having a sister, because that's what they are. They're sisters. And I have two of them, and I understand May. And you have brothers, and I'm sure you would do the same thing for your brothers, but I understand May. If I had to sacrifice something for my sibling, I would do it. If I had to. Like I it was just a really, really beautiful moment. And how quickly, let me finish my thought. Oh my gosh, Sabi. How quickly that she jumped on it, and how patient Chimera was with wiping her memory, giving them the last moment together where he waited until they were hugging.
And May even, I think, nodded at him. She was looking at him over Osha's shoulder and kind of like gave him the nod, like that he could do it. Like, he didn't just do it,
No,
he
which is so
waited.
crazy because he can't see. So he must have felt that she was ready.
And the fact that it started though with Osha saying, like, let my sister go, I'll be trained by you. So like Osha was even like trying to help May be able to leave the situation. And then Osha, when Chimer offered a solution, Osha or May accepted instantly because of that. Like, they're all, I love that scene, was so beautiful.
It was really beautiful, and I love that it was in the same place where we first met the siblings as children.
Oh, it's like poetry. It
It
rhymes.
rhymes. I also really distinctively loved how Osha was able to let go as well as May was able to let go. But it did take, like, they both get this beautiful new beginning in their own way, I think. Like and in a way, May going to Vernestra is also Vernestra's new beginning, I think. I have full confidence that Vernestra will set things right, 100%. I have full confidence in Vernestra Rowe that she will put things right, because she's been through the whole dark side aspect of having a Padawan before. And I think that I say this now, but I also said this at the beginning of season one. I think that everything will be okay. I think that everything will be okay. I don't think that. I don't know. I have faith in these characters, and I have faith in the way that they're written.
And there was a quote. I let me see if I can't find this, then it's okay. But I think I saved it. So on the topic of having like a, you know, everything will be okay, Leslie Headland said in a recent interview, you know, even though Osha and the Stranger are standing there, sort of looking out at the sunset, ready to conquer the world, but the tragedy is that we know that they don't. We know there can only be two. We know Plagueis is there. We know that these two are doomed in some way. So to me, it's a bittersweet tragedy for the, it's a bittersweet tragedy, this foreboding ending. But also, I think she also, someone also made the point that it doesn't have to end in a sense of like they don't succeed in their dark. We know that they don't conquer the world. We know that they don't succeed in their dark ways. But that doesn't mean that they don't find another way, that they don't divert from the darkness towards light. We don't know how exactly it's going to end for them. So it could end up being okay for them. It could end up being okay for May and Osha. We don't know how Chimera plays into that. But yeah.
That'll be really interesting to see how that's explored if there is a season two.
There better be. I hope so.
I know, I hope so too. I think that it would be a really great story to, you know, kind of wrap up the era before the prequels. That's a, another thing that I really felt during this final episode. It feels like the nail on the coffin to the High Republic era. It feels like it's over in this time period. Like it's done. Like the
And
golden
it
age is done.
is over.
It's finite. I was like, wow. And I have chills thinking about it. I was like, whoa.
Like there's no going back now.
No, and it reminds me
The
of the
ball is rolling. It's
yeah,
going.
it's snowballing.
Yeah, the snowball is happening.
It's avalanching. It reminds me of the comic, I think it's Star Wars. I haven't read it, but everyone knows about it, I think, at this point. But where Luke Skywalker meets Elzar Mann's conscious or whatever, or like his. Like a trapped in time form of him, and how Elzar asks about the Jedi, and Luke says that he's the last one, and Elzar's like, wow. And I was like, wow. Well, Charles Soule wrote that, I think, and then he's writing the last adult novel, so I do wonder if there will be a call back or call forward, call back to when Elzar is like, maybe one day we may be doomed by our own narrative, I guess.
I'm getting ch I so many chills in this episode. I
I
feel like this
know.
episode is our love letter to Star Wars.
Probably.
I love it.
Yeah, this was just a really, I think. What I really appreciate about the Acolyte is the amount of conversations that it enticed for people to have, no matter how nuanced or intense or emotional that they got. I think that the show was really great for that. I feel like with Andor, a lot of us were on the same page because we were witnessing the good versus the bad. We were seeing the Empire and the beginnings of the rebellion, but this is like the Jedi are always painted as good and proper and doing the right thing. And then we have this group of Jedi that for once that we've, you know, visually seen is doing the wrong thing. I don't know. Very, very interesting. I will
And
miss.
where was Yoda in all this?
He was in the closet.
He was in
That we
the
see
closet.
at the end. I was
A
like, oh
likely place
no.
for him to be.
Likely for him to be in the in the closet where there's a lot of rugs and brooms in there. You get my gist. Any final thoughts? This is not our last Acolyte discussion. We do have a special guest coming on next week where we kind of go over the whole season as an entirety. But any final thoughts on the episode before we kind of move into our outro?
No, I think we pretty much covered it. If we
Think we
missed
did
anything,
too.
we will cover it next week with our guest.
Yeah, so next week we have Molly Damon from Star Wars Explained coming on our show to talk about the entirety of the Acolyte season. We're very excited for that one. And then this Saturday, we are partnering with Geeky Waffle for a charity live stream. We are hopping on the live stream at 6 p.m. Eastern time to 6:30 p.m. and we'll be talking about the High Republic and the Acolyte. It is for Equality Now, and I know Amanda Stenberg is an advocate for that charity, and we're very excited to contribute to it. And we were so honored to be asked to be a part of this live stream. So if you'd like to join us for that, we're there from 6 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. EST.
And there's an awesome raffle going on. There's some amazing prizes being
Yeah.
offered. So you'll probably definitely want to check that out if you are a collector. Let's just
Yeah.
say there's going to be some really fun prizes there.
Yeah, there is something literally for everyone in that raffle.
Yeah.
And Editor Tom, this was an amazing prize, but Editor Tom contributed the Star Wars Celebration Anaheim special edition of the High Republic trilogy, and it's so beautiful. I have it, but on display it's gorgeous, but inside the book it's like a tome, like a beautiful, yeah, and it's signed, I think.
That's my holy grail. Like, I want that set so bad.
I got it for myself as a birthday present for my 24th, because I was like, if I start the High Republic and I love it, it'll be a good birthday present for when my birthday comes around. And I was like, okay,
Yes.
I love the High Republic. I'm getting it. But you can find me at Andorisms on TikTok, Instagram, and Twitter. You can find our pod at Stardust Records, just without the O, on Instagram and Twitter. And you can find Lindsay at
A Cosmic Love on Twitter and at Rebel Risen on Instagram and now on TikTok. I'm just trying to be more out there with everything. So I'm trying to upload some stuff. So yeah.
Yeah, so go ahead and follow us there, and we'll see you next week for our season review of The Acolyte with Molly Damon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.